It's Lit Nerves Radio with me, your host, Will Madaus. Joining me now is James Besson, a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and a lecturer at Boston University's School of Law. His new book, Learning by Doing, The Real Connection Between Innovation, Wages, and Wealth, from Yale University Press, is available on Amazon and at fine bookstores everywhere. James Besson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Hi.
In your book, you tied together some seemingly disparate threads, innovation, economics, and a lot of other different things about the structural underlyings between innovation and how that gets translated into the real world. The central example you use is, or for a lot of the book, is the power mill, the power loom. How did the power loom go from an idea to the way textiles were made?
Well, not easily, actually. Right, the power loom was one of the transformative technologies of the Industrial Revolution in this country and in England. People had played around with automated looms, mechanized weaving for a couple centuries. In the late 18th century, Cartwright developed what was considered the first commercially useful power loom, but it didn't really work very well. His business actually failed, but he succeeded enough so that other people started to make improvements, and pretty soon, within a decade or two, automated weaving, where some steps of the weaving process were automated, started spreading in England, and then in 1814, it was put into development in the United States. The initial looms were a significant advantage over the hand loom. Typically, they automated enough of the process so that a weaver could actually run two looms at once. That was significant. It meant that the early mills were tremendously profitable, but in fact, it wasn't a huge increase compared to what came later. Over the next century, there was another 20-fold increase in the amount of cloth that could be woven in an hour by a weaver. So there was this eventually this huge, huge increase, and it was developed over a long period of time through a slow incremental process of improvement where first weavers would acquire skills, weavers and mechanics and mill operators would acquire the skills needed to run the current existing version of the looms efficiently, and that took some time. And then when they saw where the bottlenecks were, they started making improvements and tweaks to the equipment, which would then require sort of a new process of learning. And this cycle went on and on and on, so that there were just a steady stream of improvements, a steady increase in the skills of the weavers, so that they were involved in what was ultimately a very different process than the traditional artisan craftsman. But, you know, that combination of skills and additional inventions and additional knowledge about how to organize the production process and things like that meant this huge growth in productivity.
You talk about how new technologies often need many rounds of refinement and enough workers to have the know-how to implement them. What are the key factors that make or break a technology during the implementation period?
Oh, that's a, you know, the introduction of a new technology can be broken many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure it would be right to identify a single or a few key factors. I think the key thing to look at is all of the knowledge involved. And I think this is where many people misunderstand how technology works, that they confuse technology with just the initial invention. And there's all this knowledge about how do you install it, how do you maintain it, how do you operate it efficiently. A lot of very mundane, very detailed knowledge, but knowledge that often cannot be obtained except through learning by doing, by trying different things, by experimenting. And those tend to be very long processes. So you need to have, a workforce and the institutions to support that workforce so that they can learn and acquire new knowledge and develop new knowledge over an extended period of time. And that's what it's all about.
Some technologies do reach mass market. What are the changes that lead to mass adoption? And how does mass adoption affect the lives of the workers in a given industry?
So right. I think we want to distinguish between just sort of the latest incremental improvement in a technology, and what I call a major technologies, you know, something like mechanization or information technology. These are major technologies, and they involve lots and lots of different things. And what you observe with sort of the evolution of major technologies is that very often in the early stages, they're very limited in terms of how well they can be applied. And, you know, the skills and the knowledge needed to implement the technology just is not very widespread. So that was the case, for instance, with the power loom. You know, you could look at early computers. You know, it was a very, very few people operated computers in the 60s. It was a restricted thing, certainly by comparison to what it is today. As the technology matures, it develops, and I think crucially becomes more standardized, then it becomes much easier for people to acquire the necessary knowledge. And so the scale of things can ramp up so that we can have personal computers where in many industries today, the majority of workers have computers and work with computers daily, as opposed to it being a very esoteric thing that only a few PhDs operate in specialized facilities, which is what it was in the 60s.
Why are standards and certification so important to getting these new technologies into the real world?
Well, standards do a couple things. One is it makes it easier to learn. So in the book, I there's this very dramatic example of the periodic table. Chemical knowledge in the early 19th century was basically learned by just doing hundreds of experiments. If you wanted to become a chemist, you worked essentially as an apprentice in a lab of a leading scientist, and you went through these various experiments, and it was a very slow and tedious process. But over time, you know, as the knowledge grew, patterns started emerging. In the 1860s, when Mendeleev, a Russian chemist, was forced to teach a new course on inorganic chemistry, he had recognized this pattern, as had some other people. But he put together a little table of the elements so that they could understand the properties of the various elements in a very simple way. They could access this table, and it would tell them that they would know what the properties of fluorine were, and that they were similar to chlorine because of where it sat on this periodic table. So what it did is it took this mass of unorganized knowledge and made it into a very standardized piece of knowledge, which could then be easily learned. What that did was it meant that the training of chemists could be radically transformed. They could now attend, learn much more in a standard university setting. So the number of chemists increased rapidly, which meant that it was now possible to set up large R&D labs where chemists could go off and do sorts of research on a much larger scale and involving many more people than they had before. So it transformed the chemical industry. We see other standards playing a similar role. The internet played a very dramatic role in and it was because the standards were there and available and open. So standards make it easier to learn, but they also are critical for establishing labor markets. So, for instance, in the late 19th century, the typewriter had been around, but different typewriters had different keyboards. So if you wanted to become a typist, or it was called typist stenographer then, you had to go to a school and you would learn one particular keyboard, and your skills weren't useful at any employer had any of the other keyboards. So the labor market was very limited. Around 1900, they coordinated on what we call the QWERTY keyboard, the standard keyboard we're all familiar with. And that made it much easier to learn because you only had to learn one keyboard, and it meant that you could work anywhere. So the number of jobs increased dramatically, but it basically increased the incentive to learn. Somebody who was a prospective typist could much more easily plunk down the money they needed to go to school to learn typing because they knew the opportunities were that much greater. So there's this sort of virtuous cycle where having a standardized technology increases the incentives to learn, and so there's more learning, which then accelerates the growth and adoption of the technology.
Take us through the life of a mill girl. Why is it at the very beginning of technology that new workers are unable to extract high wages, but later on they are able to reap those benefits? What changes in that time from their perspective?
Right. So it's very much tied up with this problem of labor markets. If you look at the early weavers, there wasn't much of a labor market then in terms of the power loom, the factory weavers. They had these very specialized skills. They learned them on the job. But because things were different from one mill to another, they weren't really able to leave one mill and go to another. I think the figure is something like in the 1830s, only 18% of the weavers who were hired had any kind of previous experience. Most of them were brand new. So that meant, on the one hand, they had to learn on the job, and they weren't particularly skilled when they walked in the door. So that employers weren't particularly motivated to, they weren't offering their employers much value that would command a high wage. And effectively, the employer paid for the learning that they did on the job, because their first 6 months on the job, they weren't really very productive. They were learning up, as they worked. Mm-hmm. When a labor market developed, then it essentially the skills were standardized. It meant that I could learn at one mill, and my skills would be valuable at a dozen other employers, a dozen other mills. So there was competition for my talents. And it drove wages up. So we saw this very dramatic thing with the weavers. For decades before the Civil War, their wages were flat, even though they were acquiring these skills on the job. After the Civil War, a robust labor market developed. Most of the mills would hire previously experienced workers, and wages went up very rapidly.
People tend to think that technology replaces jobs. You claim it merely displaces them. What is that distinction, and where do you see the evidence of that?
Right. So what I'm looking at is the total number of jobs. So, yeah, people worry that, this is a worry that's been around since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. We look at this technology, and we see that it automates some tasks. So it automates some aspects of work. And clearly we don't need human workers to do that work if the machines are going to do it. The fear has always been that it would lead to mass unemployment. That was a fear then, that's a fear now. You see it all the time in the newspapers. The tendency has been, instead, what tends to happen is that some tasks get automated, but that makes the value of other tasks more valuable, so that jobs open up either in the same occupation or in related occupations or elsewhere in the economy. But the difference is that the new jobs require new skills. So that was a concern, for instance, with the weavers back in the day. In fact, what turned out over the course of the 19th century, the power loom technology automated 98% of the labor required to weave a yard of cloth. But rather than eliminate 98% of the weavers, the actual number of weavers grew. And why did that happen? Because it also meant that the price of cloth fell, and that increased demand. It increased demand so much that the total number of weavers didn't decline. And effectively, the skills that were not, the tasks that were not automated, the skills related to those tasks became more valuable because the demand increased. We see a similar thing with that, for instance, today in bank tellers. People assume that the automated teller machine eliminated most bank teller jobs, and it's just not true. The number of bank teller jobs didn't go down in the 90s when the ATM machines came in. But it changed the nature of the job. So before, the bank tellers tend a lot of their work and their key skills had to do with cash handling. That became less important, and their ability to become sort of marketing specialists to assist customers who, today the bank teller plays a role in making bank customers feel that they can get their questions answered, that they can come in and have a variety of high value services done by people at the bank. And the bank teller is sort of the first line in that whole marketing process. That they become, I think they call it relationship banking these days. In other cases, you see what's going on is that a particular job will be, the number of jobs, in a particular occupation, the number of jobs will decline, but in a related, they'll be compensated for in a related occupation. So, for instance, we don't have nearly as many switchboard operators as we had in the past, but we have more receptionists. So again, it's a situation where the skills change. We don't have desktop publishing automated the typographers, but we now have more graphic designers composing publications. So things shift around, but all of this information technology hasn't led to mass unemployment. Mm-hmm. You can quibble about the recovery from the last recession being slower than it should have been, and maybe technology had a role in that. I think that you can point to a lot of other factors that made the recovery slow. But the big story is we're not experiencing mass unemployment today, but we are experiencing a skills gap on a very large scale where there are lots of new jobs there and people are having difficulty getting the skills to perform those jobs.
So we've seen the historical evidence, but every time one of these revolutions comes around, we find ourselves asking, is there something different about this one? Right. Is there something different about the transformation of information technologies?
Well, sure, there are differences. So information, in the past, it was largely blue-collar manual labor that was automated in the 19th century. Now we're seeing white-collar jobs being automated. I think you can argue that the pace of change is faster today than it was back then. That's something that's hard to quantify, but it certainly seems plausible. Mm-hmm. These are important differences. We don't have the same kind of institutional obstacles they had back then. They didn't have a large urban workforce in the early 19th century for these textile mills. The mills sprouted up in various places where there was water power. And, that was a problem they had to deal with that we don't really have to deal with so much today. But the general issue about, the new technology demanding new skills that are hard to acquire, to my mind, that's still there. It's still there in a very big way. There's a lot of evidence that it's there today. And I think that's going to be the case until we actually see technologies that, fully automate everything to do with an occupation or a field of industry.
That brings us to the next question is, the so-called technological, singularity. Before the spread of engines during the Industrial Revolution, we used horses for many jobs. But since, 1900, the number of working horses has shrunk dramatically. Lately, automation and artificial intelligence have meant smart machines can take on jobs that used to require a thinking human. Will machines that once rendered horses unemployed surpass us at our useful function of thinking? And what then?
Right. So it's the same story. The horse drivers, yes, we don't have very many horse drivers anymore.
But sorry, no, the horses themselves.
Well, the horses themselves, yeah, I mean, we're talking about humans. The horses themselves have been replaced by a whole bunch of other people in the transportation industry. Ostensibly, maybe even more people that were involved in dealing with horses. And it's a similar thing today that smart machines automate parts of the process. They don't automate everything. And as long as there is some work to be done, it's not clear that automation possesses any immediate threat. If we get to a so-called singularity where they're really talking about, okay, the technology is going to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people differ greatly on whether this is going to happen within 10 years or within 100 years mm-hmm. or hundreds of years, if ever. One of the great difficulties is that an awful lot of what jobs require isn't just sheer intelligence. Yes, for a long time we've had computers that can be good at picking stocks, say. But that hasn't really done much to the number of jobs for financial advisors and stockbrokers, because they do many other functions. That they provide security when the stock market's down 30%, they provide an assurance or guidance that nobody wants to hear from a computer at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite true that we've had for a long time intelligent machines that make recommendations about what to buy. Yet, there's a big gap between the ability of those devices to understand what different people's tastes and preferences are on a more personal level. So it turns out that in things like bookstores or whatever, there still is a valuable role for humans to play in terms of retailing. We have computers that in some areas can diagnose illness as well as the average doctor. But there are all these other things that a doctor does in terms of observing, getting to know a patient, providing reassurance, that computers aren't very good at. Perhaps eventually computers can play those roles, but I don't see that happening very soon. I think it's fascinating to focus on what's going to happen in 10, 20, 50, 100 years. But I think it's very important, and this is a mistake people seem to want to make sometimes, to really distinguish what's happening now from what may happen then, particularly regarding policy. So in my view, we're facing a skills gap, a problem in acquiring the skills needed to work with new technology. That's a big problem right now. If instead we focus on, oh my God, in 10 years we're going to have a singularity and everybody's going to be thrown out of work, what do? We have to redistribute income or something like that. We're not really addressing the real policy problem we're facing today. And as long as we focus on sort of the apocalyptic future, we're not going to make progress against the real issue of inequality today.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned earlier that early on in the innovation cycle, workers are unable to extract high wages for their labor. And we also mentioned that change is happening faster than ever before. So we're in a constant churn of technological change. What does that mean for inequality and wage stagnation?
So I think that's a significant challenge. If as long as things continue in churn, it means that it's going to be difficult to have things stable and standardized so that we can have well-established labor markets. What tends to happen is, if you look, say, at the occupation of graphic designer, that's an occupation that is in constant churn. So the originally, 30 years ago, typographers were involved in producing type for publication. Along came desktop publishing and graphic designers got involved. But then along came the internet and they required web design skills. And now we have mobile technology, so they require mobile skills. There are new standards coming all the time. So what happens is there's a tremendous learning problem for graphic designers. The schools can't keep up. The best designers are able to teach themselves the latest technology, and they earn high pay. But the average designer has a much harder time, and for that reason, the average designer has had stagnant wages. So there's an element where as long as that churn and instability continues, we're not providing a good way for the average designer to keep up. There's a growing gap between the top and the middle. And we're not providing a good way for the average designer essentially is not benefiting from the technology. It's not sharing in the fruits of technology.
In your book, you mentioned the work of Thomas Piketty. He thinks we're headed to the same page in the business cycle as Victorian England and France during the Industrial Revolution, the same situation to which Marx and communism were a response. What political changes should we expect from our most recent and imminent radical shifts?
So Piketty is focusing on the inequality of wealth. And we can go off and talk about that. An awful lot has been written about it, both pro and con. I think it's important to remember that in terms of the problems that I'm focusing on, which also were critical in the Industrial Revolution and the way people reacted to the Industrial Revolution. But the problem I'm focusing on is how the average worker is faring.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that there have been times in the past, in the late 19th century, for instance, when there was great inequality, in Piketty's terms, even greater inequality than there is today, and yet wages were growing rapidly. Mm-hmm. So these are, to some extent, two different problems. Clearly, if you have income inequality that's growing over a long period of time, that will lead to wealth inequality. But wealth inequality doesn't necessarily imply income inequality or wage inequality or that the middle classes can't prosper. So Marx and some of the early social critics in the 19th century were reacting to both things. They saw stagnant wages and they saw a growing inequality of wealth. I think at least in terms of stagnant wages, I think it's pretty clear that that's not what happened in the long run. The weavers' wages were stagnant for a while, but by 1910 or so, they had tripled. It just took decades before that progress occurred.
Mm-hmm. But most people, you know, in the way they view the world, don't think of things in, you know, 10, sometimes 30 years required for some technology to be implemented, but, you know, what their case is on the ground. And so if they're seeing, you know, wages, their wage stagnate, what sort of reactions do you think we should expect?
Well, there's no doubt that stagnant wages and middle-class economic opportunity are becoming more and more political issues. I mean, you're hearing candidates across the board talking about this issue. They approach it different ways. But it has been an issue for a while. You know, the median wage has essentially been stagnant for three decades now. So this is a long period of time already. I'm not optimistic that things are going to change dramatically very quickly. So this is an issue that's going to be around for a while and perhaps grow in importance.
In your book, you indicate that laws meant to protect innovation, copyright, patents, and the like, are more and more being used to actually suppress it. Another symptom of more money in politics, you write. What chances does innovation have against armies of lobbyists and patent lawyers?
Right. Well, I should be clear. What the book argues, I still think this is the most innovative country, major country. We still have a high level of innovation, but we've seen things going in some areas in the wrong direction. So, for instance, the number of startups in the U.S. has been declining. Startups have often been tied with our tremendous ability to introduce and develop new technologies. Employee mobility has been declining. There are a number of reasons for this. But it's employee mobility is often key to spreading knowledge and is often key to developing those robust labor markets that can provide the growing wages. And so When I look at some of the policy things that affect these trends, we're seeing policies tending to move in the wrong direction. For a long time, you know, these areas of policy, patents, of antitrust, of things related to employee mobility, have always been political contests over them and political battles. But the U.S. has over the long term maintained a very good balance, so that they don't overly favor a few large companies, but they allow large companies to prosper for the most part. You can compare that to other countries where often a few large companies tend to become dominant, often to the expense of the ability of startups and new technologies. So it's not just large companies. You look at some of the problems of patents and patent trolls today. We've got very effective lobbying from the patent lawyers. You look at occupational licensing, which restricts access to many technologies. We've just seen a huge surge over the last couple decades in the number of occupations that require some sort of licensing and are very often restricted by that licensing, to the point where about a third of the workforce requires some sort of occupational licensure. There are professional associations who lobby for these, mostly in the state houses. So there's this long this long-term process where it seems that in many of these areas, things have been tilting against innovation. And when I look at it, it does seem striking to me that these changes have occurred in areas where there's been a lot of lobbying and where money in politics seems to be an issue.
President Obama recently unveiled his new plan for community college to make community college more accessible. You don't buy it. What does his plan lack to truly spur innovation?
No, actually, I think Obama's plan might be helpful. I think it's hard to tell right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I conveyed the wrong impression there. I think that what I don't like is there's been this longer term trend of money in education increasingly being pushed towards 4-year colleges, where basically the community colleges and the technical schools have been left high and dry. So there was one study which found that over the decade of the aughts, the subsidies for 4-year colleges went up $14,000. Community colleges essentially remained flat. Yet it appears to me that at this point in time, it's the community colleges which may be able to play a particularly valuable role in developing new skills in some of these emerging occupations, or delivering the new skill sets that existing occupations need to migrate to, to deal with these new technologies. So, while on the one hand, community colleges are increasingly important, on the other hand, they've been starved for money. So I certainly welcome attempts that may redress that imbalance. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that very often they're dealing with students who need the most remedial help. So they theoretically might want to be providing a greater level of support for community colleges.
Mm-hmm. The government plays a key role in areas like research and development and spends billions on military spending, both fertile areas for innovation. But a lot of the plumbing behind the scenes has turned the table against innovation. For example, with the federal procurement process and how contracts are awarded, it's the example you were talking about of punishing the small firms at the expense of the large is increasingly the norm there. What has happened behind the scenes?
So military procurement, I think through history, has often or occasionally played just a very important role with key key new technologies. It played a role in the 20th century in computers, in wireless communications, in semiconductors, in the internet. Very early on, what happened was the military, for its own needs, supported projects that turned out to have great value elsewhere. But the critical thing about these programs is that they were done in a very open way. They involved small firms, they involved university researchers, they shared knowledge, they used open standards. So that what that meant was the military made its investments. It meant that a large number of diverse people acquired skills and knowledge of a new technology, and those people were then able to go in the private sector and pursue civilian applications that turned out to be incredibly valuable. It turns out, of course, that there are many military investments that are only valuable to the military and don't have this sort of what they call dual use. But often enough, there are technologies that are useful. But the key thing is that that you don't get those benefits unless things are done in an open manner, involving diverse parties, sharing knowledge, using open standards. Increasingly, over the last 30 years or so, there's been a tendency to focus a military procurement on the large contractors, to subject it increasingly to secrecy restrictions that prevent sharing of knowledge. And this has been detrimental. So while it's impressive that all of those key technologies in the 20th century were spurred by, in their early years, by military spending, we've seen very few examples recently where that happens. And instead, what we've seen is moves that restrict the access to the knowledge, and that's detrimental. I think in the recent administration, there have been some moves, particularly in DARPA, to once again involve some broader participation. I know DARPA was involved in recruiting hackers, for instance, to do research. And you're seeing some of the relaxation on the involvement of graduate students, particularly foreign graduate students, on university funding and small firm participation. So it's not all in one direction, but you know, there's been a move from the way it was in the past, and I think that's been detrimental. Procurement, by the way, isn't just an issue for the military. The government in its functions it procures lots of things. In some areas, like building technology, we've seen some studies where municipalities that support green building codes have spurred the development of that technology in their regions. We see, of course, the government is a huge buyer of healthcare services, and it's been pushing for things like new technologies like electronic health records. And here's an area where the standards are fragmented, and despite government efforts, the procurement is hobbled, and we're not perhaps seeing the bang we could be getting for the buck on these technologies.
At the most basic level, why is it that when there are skilled jobs available and unemployed people, have we failed to put those people together and give them the training that they need? And what do we have to do to achieve that?
So the key thing is to being able to provide the strongest incentives for people to learn on their own. The problem is with early stage technology, with new technologies, with technologies that are constantly churning, we don't have the schools. The schools can't keep up. People have to learn on the job, on their own. And we need institutions that can help them do that. We need labor markets that can provide them the incentives to do that. So If we can provide some degree of training assistance, often things like work study programs, one of the encouraging things is you see local employers working with local community colleges to set up programs where people learn new technologies both in the classroom and on the job. Certification of skills learned on the job. You're seeing a number of industries taking steps to provide certification programs so that skills learned on the job become standardized and replicated. We need to provide a greater ability of employees to take their skills from one employer to another. And unfortunately, that's an area where things have tended to be going in the opposite direction.
James Besson, thank you for joining us. The book is Learning by Doing, The Real Connection Between Innovation, Wages, and Wealth, out now.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Lit Nerves Radio. Thanks for listening. To listen to more, go to litnerves.com/radio. This show is produced by Matt Ellison, and I'm your host, Will Meadows.